Lecture 10, Plotting with the Freytag Pyramid.
Everybody thinks they know how to tell a joke. What that usually means in practice is that most of us understand, at least intuitively, the basic structure of the typical joke. You introduce a situation with a twist in it, the joke exploits the twist to build tension, and then the tension is released as a punchline, which usually involves a reversal of expectations. There are countless jokes that follow this structure, and depending on the content of the joke and the delivery of the joke teller, the amazing thing is that most people still find this sort of joke funny. It doesn't matter that the structure is simple and predictable. It doesn't matter that we know instinctively that the joke's going to end in a reversal. The fact is, when most of us hear the phrase, "A guy walks into a bar," our ears perk up. We know exactly what to expect. Situation, twist, punchline. You'd think this would prevent us from being surprised, and yet we also expect to laugh at the end of it. It's a very reliable, almost reflexive response. In fiction, the structure of the traditional plot works in much the same way, especially in popular fiction and very often in literary fiction as well. When we start reading a certain type of story, a mystery story, say, or a romance novel, we're given a particular situation we've seen many times before. A detective is called to the scene of a murder, or a young couple have a cute meeting. Then a conflict or a complication arises. The murdered body was found alone in a room that was locked from the inside, or the couple dislike each other intensely on first sight. Then the story or novel proceeds to work its way through the conflict. The detective searches for clues, interviews witnesses, and finds herself threatened by the murderer or someone who was protecting the murderer. The lovers circle each other warily as the rest of the plot revolves around them. Finally, the detective catches the murderer, or at least learns the murderer's identity, and the sparring lovers come to their senses, fall into each other's arms, and live happily ever after, as we always knew they would. This basic structure, situation, conflict, resolution, was first codified by the Greek philosopher Aristotle in his work The Poetics, in which he names and defines the various elements that make up a tragic drama. To this day, 2,300 years after his death, people still talk about a narrative having an Aristotelian structure. It's beyond the scope of this lecture for me to explain Aristotle's theory in detail, but suffice it to say that he was the first to state explicitly that a story should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. He was also the first to say that the events of the plot should be both causally connected and self-contained, and that the ending of the plot, and remember that he's talking specifically about tragedy here, should provide both closure and catharsis. Aristotle also introduces the concepts of the protagonist and the antagonist, or the two major characters who are in conflict with each other. But when we're talking about prose fiction these days, Freytag's Pyramid is more commonly referred to than Aristotle. Freytag's Pyramid is a graph of dramatic structure based on Aristotle's theory and created by an otherwise obscure 19th century German novelist and playwright named Gustav Freytag. This distinctive sketch of a pyramid, which is actually more of a triangle, has been a staple of literature and creative writing classes for years. And depending on who's explaining it, Freytag's Pyramid is made up of either 5, 6, or 7 elements. For the sake of completeness, I'm going to explain the 7-element version. As the name suggests, these elements are usually graphed in the shape of a pyramid. Starting at ground level on the left-hand side of the pyramid and rising towards the top, the first 3 elements are the exposition, the inciting incident, and the rising action. At the peak of the pyramid is the climax, which is the moment of greatest emotion or drama. Then the pyramid descends on the right-hand side in the falling action, the resolution, and it ends at ground level again on the other side with the denouement. In order to show this pyramid in practice, I'm going to use a story everybody knows, namely the plot of the film version of The Wizard of Oz. The exposition stage of a story sets the scene and introduces the characters. In The Wizard of Oz, the exposition is everything that happens from the beginning of the film all the way up to the tornado. During this section, we meet Dorothy Gale, who lives on a farm in Kansas with her Aunt Em and Uncle Henry, as well as the farmhands Hunk, Zeke, and Hickory. We also meet their mean neighbor, Miss Gulch, who has been bitten by Dorothy's dog, Toto, and who wants to have Toto put to sleep. As a result of this threat, Dorothy runs away with Toto and meets the medicine show pitchman, Professor Marvel. He sends her back to her family, but on her way back to the farm, Dorothy is overtaken by a storm. By time we get to the tornado, at the end of the exposition, all the major characters have been introduced. Next comes the inciting action, which is the event that introduces conflict into the story. The inciting action of The Wizard of Oz is a bit ambiguous because there are two different elements in the story that might be called the conflict. One is the conflict between Dorothy on the one hand and Miss Gulch on the other, because Miss Gulch wants Dorothy's dog put to death. This is what causes Dorothy to run away from home, leading directly to her getting conked on the head during the tornado. In that sense, you might consider Miss Gulch's threat the inciting moment. But then this conflict becomes more complicated a few minutes later, when the tornado transports Dorothy to the Land of Oz. There, Dorothy's house lands on the Wicked Witch of the East and kills her, and the witch's sister, the Wicked Witch of the West, threatens to kill Dorothy in revenge. However, this is really just the same conflict, because the Wicked Witch of the West is actually just Miss Gulch in her Oz incarnation, and in both incarnations, she wants to harm Dorothy. In fact, using Aristotle's terminology, we now have a protagonist, Dorothy, and an antagonist, Miss Gulch, aka the Wicked Witch. But there's another conflict that arises after Dorothy lands in Oz, and that's the fact that she wants to go home and nobody knows how to send her back to Kansas. These two conflicts, Dorothy versus the Wicked Witch and Dorothy's quest to go home, are linked, of course, and they get linked even more explicitly later on. Let's just say that by time Dorothy starts down the yellow brick road, the inciting incident has already happened. The rising action is the part where the plot gets more complicated and exciting, building tension along the way. Here's where you get twists and obstacles and digressions. As a result of these obstacles, in most stories, the rising action makes up the majority of the plot. In The Wizard of Oz, the rising action includes Dorothy's departure from Munchkin Land and her meetings with the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Cowardly Lion, whom we've already met in the exposition as Hunk, Zeke, and Hickory. The rising action also includes her arrival in the Emerald City, her first audience with the Wizard of Oz, who is really, of course, Professor Marvel, and her capture by the Wicked Witch of the West. Along the way, obstacles are thrown in the path of Dorothy and her companions. During the scene where she and the Scarecrow discover the Tin Man, they are attacked by the talking trees, and the witch turns up to threaten them with a fireball. Then Dorothy, the Scarecrow, and the Tin Man tame the Cowardly Lion after he attacks them, and after that, they survive the witch's attempt to put them all to sleep in the poppy field. During this part of the story, the two conflicts I mentioned earlier are reemphasized. Once Dorothy and her companions arrive in the Emerald City, the Wicked Witch's rage at Dorothy is spelled out in the sky when she writes the words, "Surrender Dorothy," in smoke with her broomstick. Then Dorothy, trembling before the big flaming head of the wizard, asks for his help in sending her home. The two conflicts are then explicitly linked when the wizard tells Dorothy he'll help her get back to Kansas if she brings him the witch's broomstick. Dorothy and her companions then face their most difficult challenge, with Dorothy getting carried away by the flying monkeys in the haunted forest, and her companions breaking into the witch's castle to rescue her. All of these scenes, from Dorothy's arrival in Oz to the final showdown in the witch's castle, constitute the story's rising action, and they make up much of the running time of The Wizard of Oz. This brings us to the climax, which is the most dramatic and exciting event in the story. The climax of The Wizard of Oz comes when Dorothy and her friends are trapped in the witch's castle, and she kills the Wicked Witch by dousing her with a bucket of water. It's without a doubt the most heart-stopping moment in the film, no matter how many times you've seen it. And at that moment, much of the film's tension is released because at least one of the conflicts, the one between Dorothy and the witch, is ended and the plot begins its descent down the other side of the pyramid. The next element is called the falling action, which is made up of the events that result directly from the moment of climax, and the element after that is called the resolution, where the main character's conflict is resolved. In a detective story, catching or revealing the killer is often the climax, after which there isn't much else to relate. In a romance, the lovers usually declare their love for each other only a few pages before the end of the novel, and just like in the detective story, not much happens after the climax. In The Wizard of Oz, after Dorothy has killed the Wicked Witch, she takes the witch's broomstick back to the wizard. Then the wizard, after a little persuading, solves the problems of the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Cowardly Lion with something for each of them out of his big black bag. As for Dorothy, he agrees to take her back to Kansas himself. That's the falling action. It shows the results of the death of the witch, but it still hasn't resolved Dorothy's second conflict, the fact that she wants to go home to Kansas. That moment, the resolution, comes when the wizard accidentally takes off in his balloon without Dorothy, and Dorothy learns from Glinda the Good Witch that she could have taken herself back to Kansas at any time by using the ruby slippers. At this point, Dorothy's conflict is finally resolved. The threat from the witch is liquidated, so to speak, and she realizes she always had the power to go home. The denouement is the ending of the story, when order is restored. The word denouement is the French word for untying, which frankly seems a little counterintuitive to me. We usually talk about tying up the loose threads of a plot, but if you think of it as referring to untying the knot of the conflict, I suppose it makes sense. But at any rate, during the denouement, we are often shown all the major characters one more time so we can see what happened to them. In The Wizard of Oz, it's the final scene in Dorothy's bedroom, where she is reunited with Aunt Em and Uncle Henry, and also with the now suspiciously familiar farmhands. Even The Wizard of Oz himself returns in the final moments in the form of Professor Marvel. Miss Gulch is nowhere to be seen because, of course, she has been killed off in her incarnation as the Wicked Witch. In this final scene, both Dorothy and the narrative are literally returned home, back to where they both began. In some stories, this simply means that order has been restored and the world is now back to the way it was. But this isn't always the case, and it's certainly not the case in The Wizard of Oz. Dorothy is back home, where she wanted to be, but this is not to say that everything is back to the way it was before she went to Oz. Dorothy's understanding of herself and her place in the world has profoundly changed. After the strangeness and the violence she experienced in Oz, order has been restored, but she is a wiser and stronger person. Now, I've gone into so much detail about this particular structure because it's the sturdy, reliable, ubiquitous, and often predictable structure of countless books, stories, plays, movies, and television series. And predictability is not necessarily a bad thing. Predictability can be enormously reassuring and satisfying. I've seen The Wizard of Oz probably at least once a year for the last 50 years. The tornado never fails to thrill me, the witch never fails to terrify me, and Dorothy saying goodbye to the Scarecrow never fails to make me cry. The appeal of this simple, sturdy structure runs deep. Some people even think there's something instinctual about it, something hardwired in our consciousness that makes us want to see the world ordered into stories like these. The disadvantage of this traditional structure, however, is that it can also be a one-size-fits-all straitjacket. Think of the countless best-selling novels or blockbuster movies that are pretty much cut to the same pattern. With too many conventionally plotted novels, you can not only guess the ending after the first few pages, you can often guess it from the jacket copy before you even open the book. The publishing industry and Hollywood don't exactly help the situation by turning out books and movies that are carbon copies of earlier books and movies that have done well. But we as readers bear some of the blame by rewarding the predictable and the reassuring, and by making it harder for more offbeat forms of storytelling to succeed. Sometimes you feel both reassured and annoyed at the same story. You may have guessed during the first 10 pages that the sparring lovers are eventually going to get together. But imagine how disappointed and annoyed you would be if it turns out at the end that they don't really like each other after all, and they wind up with other people. Or worse, they wind up alone. The predictable can be both disappointing and seductive at the same time. Even so, this particular narrative structure has proved to be surprisingly adaptable, considering that when first Aristotle and then, centuries later, Gustav Freytag outlined it, they were thinking only of stage tragedies. Plays, obviously, have a limited running time, and because of that limited running time, a limited number of scenes and characters. The plays Aristotle was familiar with, in fact, usually focused on the fate of a single central character, such as Oedipus or Medea, or some other character from Greek history or mythology. He had never seen a novel, and certainly not a novel that works on an epic scale and incorporates lots of characters, more characters than you can fit into most plays. And yet the Aristotelian structure can be applied to everything from comedy to tragedy, from thrillers to love stories, from Hamlet to the X-Men. And for writers who are just starting out, Freytag's pyramid can serve as a set of training wheels, especially if you're uneasy about plotting. It's so common in our culture, in fact, that many writers adopt it instinctively, without really thinking about it. My own first novel, The Wild Colonial Boy, can easily be graphed on Freytag's pyramid. And yet, at the time I was writing it, I had never heard of Freytag's pyramid. I was just feeling my way through the story organically, or so I thought. The fact that my book can easily be plotted along the pyramid is just proof of how deeply ingrained in our culture it is, as if it actually were something natural and instinctive. Freytag's pyramid seems so instinctive and ubiquitous because, in its simplest form, it is often the foundation for what I'm going to call a binary plot. I'm going to talk in more detail about binary plots in lectures 13 and 14, when I talk about how to start and how to end a narrative. But for now, I'll just say that a binary plot is one in which an either-or question is posed near the start of the narrative, and then answered at the climax or resolution of the narrative. Who is the murderer? Will the two lovers ever get together? Will Dorothy ever get back to Kansas? There are all sorts of ways to complicate the answers to those questions, which I'll explore in the later lectures. But while we're talking about the traditional plot as a whole, I want to emphasize that there are ways to complicate this kind of plot long before you ever get to the end. A binary plot structured according to Freytag's pyramid doesn't have to be a simplistic or unsophisticated one. For one thing, you can scale up the story to take in a lot more time and many more characters than Aristotle or Freytag had in mind. You can do this by weaving together several binary plots or Freytag pyramids into one larger narrative. Take the great 19th century novel Middlemarch, for example, by the writer Mary Ann Evans, who wrote under the pen name George Eliot. It does have a main character. Dorothea Brooke is a beautiful, intellectual, and naively idealistic young woman. And it has a central plot line. Dorothea enters into a marriage with a much older religious scholar named Casaubon because she admires his intellect and his moral character. The marriage, predictably, is a disaster, because Casaubon is a mediocre scholar and a passionless husband. It also fails because Dorothea is attracted to an intense young man her own age named Will Ladislaw. This love triangle is the central story of Middlemarch, but it takes up no more than a third of the book. There are two other major romantic relationships in the book. These include another unhappy marriage between an ambitious young doctor named Lydgate and a beautiful but shallow young woman named Rosamund, and a budding romance between Rosamund's charming but unreliable brother Fred and an earnest young woman named Mary. There's nothing unconventional or avant-garde about Middlemarch. Instead, it convincingly demonstrates that a conventionally plotted novel can still be sophisticated and true to life. Dorothea's story is plainly the narrative spine of the book, with a clearly defined beginning, middle, and end. But her story is enriched and complicated by all the other plot lines, each of which has a similar structure. Apart from a few flashbacks, all these plot lines move forward chronologically, but they are threaded together and interlinked, and in many cases, the events in one plot line have an effect on the others. The result is that it would be impossible to plot all of Middlemarch on only one Freytag's pyramid. Instead of one main story, we have several, all woven together, each one with its own conflict, rising action, and resolution. There's another way you can complicate a traditional plot, which I'm going to call the fractal plot. A fractal is a kind of mathematical pattern which is self-similar, which means that the pattern as a whole looks the same at a distance as it does up close in detail. Fractals often appear in nature. Trees are an excellent example. The limbs of a tree coming off the trunk make the same basic pattern as the branches coming off each limb, and the twigs make the same pattern coming off each branch, and so on. You can even take it down to the level of individual leaves, where the veins spread across each leaf like the pattern of branches. The point is, no matter whether you look at the tree from across a field or peer very close up at a single leaf, you're always going to see essentially the same branching pattern. That's a fractal. You can create the same effect with large-scale narratives in novels that run in series, such as George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire. There's a single binary question posed by Martin's books. Who will sit on the Iron Throne and be the king or queen of Westeros? But because the books involve so many rival factions and so many individual characters, this larger binary plot is made up of a huge number of smaller but no less compelling binary plots at nearly every level. Just below the level of the main binary question are several largest questions. Will the Starks defeat the Lannisters? Will the Night's Watch keep the White Walkers north of the Wall? Will Daenerys Targaryen bring her dragons back to Westeros? These separate plot lines play out over the course of several books. Below that level are binary questions that play out over the course of a single book. For example, will Brienne of Tarth deliver Jaime Lannister to King's Landing? These single-volume plot lines usually involve the fate of a single character or pair of characters. Within each book, each individual chapter can also be plotted out as a little Freytag pyramid. In each chapter, the point of view character, whether it's Tyrion Lannister or Arya Stark or Daenerys Targaryen, is usually faced with a problem at the beginning of the chapter, which is resolved or complicated by the end of the chapter. Obviously, these little pyramids are not as complex or detailed as the overarching one that describes the whole narrative. For example, with many of the chapters, you already know the characters and the setting, so Martin can dispense with exposition. But even so, Martin's narrative uses a traditional narrative pyramid, situation, conflict, climax, resolution, at every level. There's one overarching pyramid that governs the whole story, but it's made up of lots of smaller pyramids. The plot of A Song of Ice and Fire is a fractal, in other words. You can see the same pattern at every level, whether it's the whole series, an individual book, or an individual chapter. It's pyramids all the way down. If you've ever wondered, as I have, how Martin keeps all these plot lines and characters and all that backstory straight, I think this structure may be the key to it. By breaking the larger story down into smaller pieces, and breaking those pieces into even smaller pieces, it's possible for him to move ahead with a really huge narrative without getting lost or discouraged. Now, for those of us who aren't planning to write a narrative that runs for 10,000 pages, there are other ways you can run interesting variations on the Freytag pyramid that don't involve keeping track of hundreds of characters. For example, you can create something I'll call a leapfrogging or contrapuntal narrative. There's a lot of variations to this, but I'll limit it to four. The first is a narrative that tells a single story, but tells it from the points of view of multiple characters, each one taking a turn before handing the story off to another character. Perhaps the most famous example of this is William Faulkner's novel, As I Lay Dying. This book tells the story of the Bundrans, a family of Mississippi farmers, and how they cope with the death of the family's mother, Addie. Before she died, Addie made her husband Ants promise that he'd bury her in the town of Jefferson, which is an inconvenient distance away. The novel is a blackly comic account of how the family carries her coffin all the way to town. He could have told the story in a straightforward fashion with a third-person narration, but instead, Faulkner decided to narrate the entire novel from the points of view of 15 different characters. Each character speaks in the first person, trading off with the other members of the family, as well as with people they meet along the way. It's a technically adventurous book, but it tells an old-fashioned story, one that includes all the elements of the Freytag Pyramid. The difference is that each piece of the story is told by a different character. Another type of leapfrogging or contrapuntal narrative you could try is the one that tells several equally important stories that remain separate for much of the book, but which come together at the end for a single climax. In fact, A Song of Ice and Fire is a crazily complex version of this type of narrative, but let's look at a slightly simpler version. There's no more old-fashioned a storyteller than J.R.R. Tolkien, and his masterpiece, The Lord of the Rings, builds to one of the biggest climaxes in the history of literature, namely the eruption of Mount Doom in the third volume of the trilogy, The Return of the King. But if you look at how he gets there, Tolkien is a surprisingly adventurous plotter. By the end of the first volume, The Fellowship of the Ring, the story essentially splits into three equally important strands. You have the story of Frodo, Sam, and Gollum making their way to Mordor. You have the story of Merry and Pippin's kidnapping by the orcs. And you have the story of Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli as they search for Merry and Pippin. Again, there's an overarching story here, namely the quest to destroy the One Ring. You also have a single overarching chronology. But while you're reading The Lord of the Rings, you're shifting back and forth among the three stories, which take place at vast distances from each other, even if they take place at the same time. If you outline the whole story, taking into account all of its various branches, you'll see a lot of smaller Freytag pyramids the way you would with A Song of Ice and Fire. Let me recommend two more styles of contrapuntal narrative. One is commonly used by modern historical novelists. The old-fashioned historical novel focuses exclusively on a period or an episode in the past, but a number of contemporary historical novels weave two main stories together, usually a story from the past and a story from the present, which are linked somehow. A great example is A.S. Byatt's novel Possession. The historical half of the novel is about a passionate love affair between two Victorian poets, and the contemporary half is about a group of modern academics who are competing with each other to find out the truth about this long-rumored affair. It's fundamentally an old-fashioned plot, and it builds to a very spooky climax in a graveyard at night. It's made up of two equal plot lines which feature characters who can never meet with each other because they live in different centuries. And yet the outcome of one plot determines the outcome of the other. There are other parallelisms as well. The pair of lovers in the 19th century are matched by a pair of lovers among the competing academics in the 20th century, for example. And there's one more type of leapfrogging narrative. As I've said before, the basic murder mystery is usually a contrapuntal story. It's the most basic kind of binary plot there is: who killed the victim? But the answer is often arrived at in a complicated way. There's the present-day story, which usually starts with the discovery of the body and follows the progress of the investigation. And then there's the story of the recent past, which ends with the murder. Looked at chronologically, one story, that of the murder, ends just as the other story, that of the investigation, begins. But the way most murder mysteries are structured, you start with the investigation and work backwards into the story of the murder, learning it in bits and pieces, and often out of chronological order. Nobody would call most murder mysteries avant-garde, but even the most run-of-the-mill of them does interesting things with plot and chronology. In the next lecture, I'm going to talk some more about the traditional plot, taking a look at ways you can rearrange or adapt the individual pieces of it, plus some other common techniques you can use to make the plot more complex and intriguing. We'll be looking at examples from Shirley Jackson, James Baldwin, Toni Morrison, and Flannery O'Connor. And in the lecture after that, I'll talk about the plotless or non-traditional narrative. These narratives work outside the lines of the Freytag pyramid, but each one nevertheless has a structure. Every work of fiction has a structure, even if it doesn't have a plot. In the meantime, I'll leave you with a very simple but very fruitful exercise. Take some of your favorite books or movies or television shows and see if you can graph them on Freytag's pyramid. I think you'll find a couple of interesting things. One is how common a structure it is, but you'll also find how often the structure of narrative is not a single pyramid, but a more complicated tangle of many pyramids, like the structures of As I Lay Dying, or Middlemarch, or A Song of Ice and Fire. If you don't want a traditionally structured plot to become a straitjacket, you need to walk a fine line between being too predictable on the one hand and disappointing the reader on the other. You want the reader to be satisfied and not feel betrayed by your climax, but on the other hand, you don't want them to see it coming. This particular structure has survived for a couple thousand years, partly because it can be reassuring. But it has also survived because it has turned out to be remarkably adaptable and capable of being bent into all sorts of interesting shapes without breaking.